Chapter 7 The Reconquest of Breastall Vale. The next week was very busy. I barely slept at all. Tyndall started contacting me magically every night to report on the progress of the next wave of Bovali. There was a final one after this that wouldn't be able to travel until the weather cleared, mostly dotards, babies, or the sick and wounded. They were still in the care of Sir Runcil, one of Sayakusi's other gentleman knights who had elected to stay on with the refugees. But the main column of Bovali was coming up the Bontal River on four massive barges, more than 50 families, and hundreds of straggling, lonely, displaced survivors of Bovali were arriving, at my expense, to begin their new lives. My two apprentices, Tyndall and Rondal, were herding them along, with the help of a dozen community leaders. They had found their welcome increasingly cold at the old ducal castle where they had been quartered, and while some of them found a new home in the coastal region, the others were anxious to take me up on my offer of a new start. But getting ready for 1,000 new people in the middle of winter wasn't easy. Feeding them and keeping them warm were the biggest headaches. We had prepared as many shelters as we could, but even with the castle stuffed to the battlements and all my yeomanries packed to the rafters, we still lacked a place for over 20 families. A place in Sevendor, that is. Sir Kay, Captain Farando, and I had been plotting and planning this entire time to kill 2 goblins with 1 arrow. We had people to quarter, and no good shelter to do so. We also had 1/3 of my realm that had to be recaptured, eventually, and unfriendly neighbours who would object to that. But the thing is, feudal states just do not make war in the winter. It's too cold and too difficult to forage for warhorses and oxen teams, so only professional mercenaries will usually fight after the autumnal equinox. Peasants and knights would rather stay drunk by the fire all winter. Considering any kind of military action before the thaw was just unheard of. This gave us a big advantage over Gimbal of West Flaria. He wasn't expecting us to move on Breastall until spring at the earliest. We needed it now. I hadn't been to tour the tower there myself, but I'd sent several native Sevendori to scout on one pretext or another. I'd even climbed halfway up Matten's Helm to peer at the squat stone structure through mage sight, until I was satisfied I had a good idea of the place's defences. And, of course, I tapped Sir Kay's ability to gather rumour and gossip, until I knew the names of just about everyone in Breastall, as well as what they did. The eastern lobe of my fief had been taken in conquest and given to Sir Ganulan, the pimply-faced 16-year-old bastard of Sire Gimbal, but the boy rarely stayed in Breastall, leaving it in the charge of his uncle on his mother's side, Sir Lanulan, and from what I heard about him, he and Sir Erenthal could have been twins. Sir Lanulan was in his 40s and was missing 2 fingers on his left hand, thanks to a bad dog bite in his past. He stayed drunk most of the time and ran Breastall like it was his own. He had a tiny garrison of 10 men who were usually as drunk as he was, and they oversaw a single village, actually closer to a hamlet, and a few dozen isolated subsistence farmsteads. The peasants of Breastall were singularly worse off than their Sevendori kin, with higher taxes and greater fees than even Sir Erenthal had levied. Sir Lanulan apparently prided himself on his ability to squeeze every iron penny he could out of the land, and if that meant slowly starving his workers to death, he didn't mind. That meant that the few people left in Breastall likely wouldn't protest a change in management. In fact, Gerlaw was kin to one family there, and indicated that they would welcome a reconquest. I found that encouraging. Something else interesting came to me during that time. A wandering foot wizard named Bannermore found his way to my gates, having heard the rumour of Mage Lord and Irionite. Bannermore was a common sort of unregistered foot wizard, more rogue than mage, but he did have more than a lick of talent and a truly entertaining patter, enough to impress peasants and artisans and more than a few nobles. He had tarried at Gimbal's seat in West Flaria for a few days, and during that time he had learned that Gimbal, too, was planning a big Yule celebration for his vassals. Bannermore was more than willing to tell us all he knew, in exchange for dinner in the Great Hall and a few cups of wine. As it turned out, all of Sire Gimbal's vassals and yeomen were all bidden to ride to their lord's fortress with their castellans, as Gimbal desired to receive their oaths personally, and not by proxy this year for some reason. It occurred to Sir Kay that the main reason to do so would be to evaluate how many men Gimbal could rally for a spring campaign against Sevendor. Bannermore, who wasn't nearly as magically talented as he was observant, agreed, and added that the prevailing rumour in West Flaria was that a depraved mage had enchanted the Duke into giving me Sevendor, and how I was sure to unleash magical hell on the folk of the Riverlands the way I had destroyed the Alshari Wilderlands. The fact that I was also reputed to be rich, and buying up grain so fast that the price was rising in the region beyond reason, wasn't helping. That wasn't quite true, but four times so far I had to order oats and corn from Sashtalia and elsewhere, not to mention a few wagon loads of silage, enough, apparently, to affect local supply and drive up prices in some districts. The West Flarian cottagers who had returned after working in Sevendor had been telling tales of wonder far beyond the modest spells I'd been able to cast, and as such things do, the tales had grown in the retelling. That could be a good thing or a bad thing. But the general tenor of the people of those lands, as opposed to their lords, was cautious, not antagonistic. While they were scared of magic, they were more worried about higher flour prices and the prospect of a new tax to pay for a war against me. Gimbal's popular support for a war was limited to his vassals and yeomen, most of whom he was related to. His subjects in his conquered territories weren't very happy with the idea at all. About a week before Yule, Sir Kay and Captain Ferrando came to me with a plan, a simple, elegant, and highly effective plan. I loved it, and gave it my most heartfelt support. It turned our weaknesses into advantages, and simplified our security situation admirably. Just the kind of magic and military action I like. First, we posted a permanent watch on Brestall Tower, which was easy enough. You could see nearly everything that happened in the Eastern Vale from the ridge top overlooking Sagal's new holding, and for days we had a lad or two concealed in the underbrush, just observing. They watched messengers on foot and horse come and go, mostly, and just a hint of activity with an eye towards celebrating the winter solstice. Then we sent three small parties of Bovali bowmen into strategic locations, overlooking the split in the road at the entrance of the valley. It didn't take long, with the help of some magic, to build two small redoubts in the highlands overlooking the stream and road. With their big Alshari Wilderland longbows, Bovali could hit anything that came through from either side. They stayed concealed for the most part, and I didn't mind throwing a couple of spells to discourage anyone from actually seeing them. The third party was stationed in the ruined old border tower, using the burned-out husk and the fallen rubble around it as cover. The tower was well-placed, commanding a view of the entire entrance to the Vales. They were instructed to lay low and observe until they were signalled. So when Sir Lanyalan and six of his men rode out of Brestall Tower 3 days before Yule, dressed in what passes for finery among drunken men-at-arms, there were only five soldiers guarding Brestall Tower, the five who hadn't been able to talk their way into the party. I could have taken the damn thing myself. In fact, I nearly did. Instead, we waited until Sir Lanyalan and his men had passed beyond our sight into Flaria, and then we attacked the next morning, an hour before dawn. Taking an escort of five men, I crossed over into Brestall Vale just as the morning star was rising. One of the bowmen killed the lone sentry, who was apparently sleeping at the gate and was unloved by his fellows. I kept the others from waking with another spell over the top floor of the squat tower, where the barracks was located. I used a cantrip to part the rusty chain that raised the portcullis, and we had effectively retaken Brestall Vale. Hardly a battle for the ages. I had the four surviving soldiers stripped and taken to the dungeons of Sevendor Castle to await my judgment. Then five wagons from Sevendor arrived with fresh supplies culled from our own. By mid-morning, the makeshift banner I was using as a device, the stars and wands figure I had sketched to Sir Kay a few weeks earlier that neither of us was satisfied with, flew from the sole battlement of the tower. Sevendor domain was whole again. I detailed Sir Kay and Captain Ferrando to interview the peasants from the village, as well as distribute gifts of blankets, furs, bread and meat, the first they'd had in months. I personally gave them a keg of decent cider, a couple of hams and a slaughtered goat, and passed out a few dozen copper pennies. They were far more wretched than their peers in the Western Vale, with even more threadbare clothes, less sturdy dwellings, and an abysmal amount of firewood laid in for winter. Almost all of them were villeins. Less than a quarter were freemen. The folk of Brestol were confused, until Sir Kay informed them that Sevendor had retaken Brestol, and then they were ecstatic. When they saw the new banner, and a few dozen armed soldiers wandering around, as well as some freely distributed food and clothes, you would have thought we were the gods themselves, the way the Brestali treated us. If the village was worse off than Sevendor, Brestol Tower at least was better than Sevendor Castle had been when we'd arrived. It was a single square tower, 4 stories tall, including the wooden tower that rose from the top and the storage room under the keep. Following the fashion of the time at which it was built, instead of the more modern square merlons, the crenellations were triangular and much larger than necessary. Brestol Tower kind of looked like it had cat ears. The keep was surrounded by an uncrenellated curtain wall of dry, mortared stone, within which were several outbuildings, a half-dozen cottages built against the wall, the kitchen, and the stable. The bailey, in turn, was surrounded by a wooden palisade that supported the mound. Finally, a ditch acted as a dry moat, without a drawbridge, but with the wooden bridge over the expanse well covered by emplacements where, according to our prisoners, invaders such as we would have been stopped with crossbows. Sir Lanyulin might have been as much of a sot as Sir Arental, but he also had a master close at hand to oversee him. We found the tower moderately well provisioned, and 2 rooms on the 2nd story were almost homey. The actual defences were laughable, and the soldiers only suitable for bullying peasants. But the interior, and the few outbuildings, were sufficient to house 10 families comfortably, twice that in a pinch. And with the Bovali due to arrive in 2 days, they were about to make port at Sendaria, we were in a pinch. While Sir Kay and the others straightened things out at the tower, I took my escort, augmented by a dozen ecstatic Brestali, north along the road to the low pass. By lunchtime, I had moved Sevendor's misplaced boundary stone back into its proper position in the pass, to the cheers and applause of my new subjects. Okay, maybe a few 100 feet past its original position. I needed to make a statement, a very powerful, visible statement, that demonstrated that things in Sevendor were different now. The gap between the ridges was too wide to defend adequately, I decided, even if the tower was rebuilt. I decided a protective dike would be a wise idea, to at least limit the entry to something we could control. Digging ditches isn't too hard, magically speaking, even in this rocky territory. I summoned an earth elemental and spent another hour rearranging the many boulders in the pass in a line at its narrowest point on each side, making it a bit more defensible. The gap between the 2 ridges was over 300 yards wide, but that just made it a challenge to my new abilities. Seeing just how much I could accomplish with the witch sphere, I directed the elementals to scratch a deep trench on either side of the river and road, piling the fill behind it. It was the crudest of defences, 2 big, long piles of dirt and rock that narrowed the neck of the pass to 50 feet, enough to permit the stream egress, and to let a man walk from one side of the pass to the other and always have cover from the Flarian side. The Brestali peasants were awe-struck. The Bovali men-at-arms were impressed. When I was done, I posted a half-dozen stalwart Bovali with longbows and swords at the dike, and ever after it was so guarded, day and night. My men's mission was simple. No one got into or out of Sevendor without my leave. As such, news of the reconquest didn't reach Flaria until 3 days after Yule, and by then it was far too late for them to do anything about it. The night before Yule, just as the full moon rose, the first of the new Bovali settlers' wagons came through the narrowed pass and passed through the new dike fortification to see their new land for the first time. Compared to how we had found it, 6 weeks of hard work, a small fortune in gold, and a powerful amount of magic, had transformed my domain into something they could, someday, be proud of. Sir Kay and a score of native Seven Dori greeted them at the watchtower and offered mulled wine and sweet biscuits against the chill as a welcome. Luckily, the nights had been dry of late, with little snow, allowing them to make good time over the hard frozen road through West Plaria, enemy territory now. As they came through, Sir Kay and his assistants directed them to various points for the night. Some went to the shelters put up in the commons, some were to encamp on Gurisam's tiny common, some went to Brestall Tower for the night, and many went directly to Sevendor Castle, where Alia and I greeted them before settling them in the outer bailey. It was a happy reunion. I saw many good people I'd made friends with, and who I hadn't seen since that fateful day my ex-girlfriend and I used sex magic to open a magical portal and rescue them from the dead god. I saw people I'd helped find wandering cows for, or driven the rats from their barn. They were footsore and tired, but happy to be in their new home. Farmers and herders, artisans, their wives and families, and children, lots of children. Most of the children were in this caravan, and their laughter and squeals of joy abounded, a sound which was pleasant to hear in the castle. At first, it was pleasant, and then people started to thank me, and thank me, and thank me, for saving their lives, for running the siege, for standing up to Sire Kusi, and for giving them a home when they were lost and dispossessed. It didn't take long before it was overwhelming. I sat in the chair at the head of the hall, a small canopy overhead letting everyone know I was the Lord, and I got aggressively thanked all evening. One grown man after another broke down in tears and bowed like I was a duke. Proud men, strong men, crumbled in front of me and wept like children in gratitude. Women wailed tearfully, begging for my blessing on their children. Entire families fell to their knees and sang praises to the gods in my name. It was overwhelming. Thankfully, Lady Alia intervened. She looked radiant, wearing a white gown and a light blue mantle as big as a tent. She wore the big green emerald I'd given her for our wedding day on a golden chain, augmented with a spell to make it sparkle and glow when she wore it. She looked as regal as a queen, and her gentle smile, familiar face, and beautiful laughter helped soothe and cheer the exhausted and overwrought Bovali. Lady Alia excused us both at one point, claiming she needed my magical assistance to make her more comfortable with the baby. She did have to pee. She always had to pee, but that's not what she needed help with.
"Men, you've got to stop getting so worked up. You're making people uncomfortable," she said when she came out of the privy.
"Making them uncomfortable?" I gasped. "Weren't you paying attention? They're nearly deifying me out there."
"They're just grateful is all," she soothed,
rubbing her hands across my chest.
"You, and you alone, saved them from the goblins. That would have been enough. But then you invite them to come to Sevendor to live as free men, keeping them all together. And you paid for them to come, fed them, clothed them, and greeted them with a warm hall and a friendly face of a kind lord."
She shook her head.
"Men, if it wasn't for you..."
"I just did what I had to, Alia,"
I said desperately. "I wasn't looking for adoring followers.
Sweet Brigger, they're acting like a cult."
Her attitude changed, quickly. That was happening a lot lately.
"So, you're basically complaining that your new subjects, upon whom you and your family security and welfare will ultimately depend, are too loyal and devoted? Well, they don't need to treat me like a demigod. That's a hell of a lot to live up to."
"They're grateful," she repeated.
"Worse, they are grateful, they're beholden, and they have nothing but the clothes on their back. They feel miserable for being away from home and terrified of being in a strange land. They are here by your grace alone, and that is a terrible burden on them. They have nothing left to offer you but their lives, so that is what they are offering you. You must give them the opportunity to express that gratitude and by your grace accept it."
"It makes me feel naked,"
I said, shaking my head, not in the pleasant way, the naked in the middle of temple services way.
"They want to name babies after me."
"Let them," she insisted. "Believe me, men, this is all very frightening to me. Leaving home, the
The siege? Getting pregnant? Fleeing for our lives? Living with your parents? Getting married? Getting ennobled? Coming here? Trying to put this place into shape? And to be honest, tonight is the first time I felt like this might be home. I feel just as they do. I feel frightened. But you make it go away, Min. You've got that idiot boyish smile, that confident bearing, and you treat everyone, villain or lord, with respect and thoughtfulness. And so I'm grateful, because you didn't have to do that, and you did. As grateful as they are, and 8,000 times more, but the only thing I have to offer you is myself. And if you don't let me do that, well, then that just leaves me frightened.
Offer yourself? I asked, surprised. Do you think we have time? She slapped me playfully.
No, we really don't.
Unless you command it, Mage Lord, she added saucily.
But I understand how you feel, too. They're treating me almost as much like some divine heroine as you. I've had 200 hands on my belly tonight, and old ladies cry on me and give me advice. I'm a God's damned living symbol of hope, and my biggest claim to it is the fact that I'm sleeping with the Lord of the Domain. But I've got to smile serenely and let them paw me, because we're all they've got. We're the only ones in all of Kalador who give a damn about them, and they know it. So shut up, conjure up a smile on your face, and let these people weep in gratitude for an evening. We have to be the lord and lady they need, or they're going to go mad.
How did you get so wise? I asked, shaking my head and kissing her forehead.
I don't have to be wise. I'm pregnant.
The rest of the evening I did just that. I wandered the hall and shook hands and laughed and drank with my new subjects. I did my best to play the lord for them, and even consented to do a few colourful cantrips in the air for their amusement. It also got their attention. So I decided to address them. I blamed the wine. For the newcomers, I brought them up to date. I told them about my raising an army in Alshar and convincing Castol to bring another face to the hordes, and how we had triumphed and kept the heart of the five duchies from the clutches of the dead god. I told them how I had met Sire Kusi in his dark visage on the field of battle. That produced some terrified looks. I told them about how poor the state of Sevendor had been when we arrived, and all the work we had done and all the work yet to be done. I told them of the fractured state of the domain and of our recent recapture of Brestal. And I told them that it was possible that some other lord would try to wrest those lands from me if I did not defend them. Before I was done speaking, 3 dozen swords had flashed out of their scabbards and were laid at my feet. So did a pile of daggers and bows from those who hadn't thought to arm themselves better. The growl from the Bovali was intimidating, and between that and the sudden display of naked steel, the few native Sevendori in the hall blanched. I hadn't really expected the spontaneous show of support, and it took me aback. It's a Wilderland's custom. The Riverland's equivalent was to take a knee and offer your hand to your lord symbolically. It's more civilized, but the gesture is usually reserved for the gentry. The Bovali were commoners, free Wilderland peasants who technically could not bear arms without leave of their lawful lord. I saw that most of the swords that were solemnly placed at my feet were the plain sort, issued to them during the siege from the armory of Boval Castle, serviceable for defending a castle's walls, but hardly blades of any note. They had not given them up when they went through the portal. They had used them to protect themselves on their long, difficult journey. I had already heard about a few altercations with locals and bandits along the way, where only their swords had kept them from being imprisoned, enslaved, or robbed. They were rough blades of poor steel, but they had been earned by their blood at Boval Castle. Their pledge of loyalty was as heartfelt and sincere as any oath of fealty from a knight to his liege. One of the several unofficial leaders of the caravan, Goodman Loas, stepped forward and vowed to be my man, defend my land with his blood, and submit himself to my rule. Loas was a popular man, a prosperous shepherd from the south of Boval Vale. He had led the men of his village on the walls during the siege, and done it well and bravely. He'd lost a son and a brother in the battle, but had 2 more sons and a daughter who were with him today. He raised his voice so that everyone could hear. "We're your men, Lord Minelan,"
he said passionately. By all the gods and all that's holy, we're yours, now and forever. You saved us from the goblins when Sire Kusi wouldn't. You got us the hells out of there when there just weren't no way. You got the Duke to put us up at that manor down south, and then you brought us up here, back to the mountains. No one else looked out for us but you, he said reverently. You need to keep some ruffians out? Well, we Bovali learned how to fight in the siege, and a few nights are nothing compared to what we're used to, he said, earning a chuckle from the crowd. By fire and blood and stone, sire, we're yours to the death. Are we not? There was a deafening cheer that nearly frightened me. I stared at Alia, my eyes wide, who emphasized her own broad smile to encourage mine. I inhaled sharply and stood on the stone table under the largest mage light. One after another, the men of Bovall Vale stood forth in my hall and promised to defend me, my heirs, and my lands. The Seven Dori were anxious when they saw so many weapons among those of obvious common blood. I felt the act demanded a response. So I gave one, and I chose my words carefully. If you're offering your service, I accept. If you're offering your loyalty, I gladly take it. The fact is, I'm as new at this as all of you are, and I cannot promise I will always be the wisest of lords. But know this, if you offer me your swords, I shall not use them lightly. This is my home. I invite you to make it yours as well. There are already people here, of course. And the Seven Dori are a sturdy, hard-working folk. Respect them, their customs and traditions. But they've been used to a neglectful lord and a hopeless life. They have just had their land invaded by strangers, which I know you all can sympathize with, and they are likely to be cautious. But tomorrow is Yule, the day of the winter solstice, the day that legends say the gods came to Kalador, a day of celebration, of new beginnings. A day of hope in the darkness of winter. Tomorrow, by tradition, the lord of the land takes oaths of fealty from his vassals. If you wish to swear to me at that time, I will gladly accept your swords. I ask but you spend one day in Sevendor first, so that you make your oaths knowing what you're getting. It'd have to be a damn sight worse than some of the places we've seen, Loas said, shaking his graying head. I'll spend the day before bending my knee, Mage Lord, but where the hells else would I go? There was a guilty laugh that ran through the hall at the remark. It was funny because it was true, and uncomfortable because it was true. I didn't know what to say to that, so I called for more wine and more ale, neither of which was ever unwelcome, and it distracted everyone from noticing the tears in my eyes. Sir Kay came in long past midnight, with the last of the wagons. He was exhausted, as was everyone else. I made a point of gathering the leaders of the caravan, including my two apprentices, and drinking a toast to them all before retiring. Things wound down after that, and I found myself being dragged to bed by Alia just as the sky was getting pink in the east.
All that, and we still have to face Yule tomorrow, she yawned as we entered our tower chamber. I thought you did very well for your first night playing the Lord.
You have them all fooled, she teased.
And if I had them fooled, so did you, my lady, I said, aping a thick Alshari peasant's accent.
Hard to believe we haven't been doing this all our lives. It certainly feels like we have, she yawned. I fell asleep the moment my head touched the pillow. The day of the winter solstice dawned just after I went to bed, cold and clear. A light wind out of the west mitigated by our protective hills. I didn't awaken until near noon, and then only grudgingly and because I find the smell of bacon intrinsically enchanting. But it was Yule, and I've always loved the season. I dragged myself out of bed, ate, and then threw myself into the festivities. The hall of the castle was decked out with evergreen boughs and winter berries, gathered that morning from the grove in the outer bailey. A huge fire roared in the fireplace, heating the place nicely. Once it was augmented by magic, the great hall was still drafty as a beggar's purse. We needed to invest in some tapestries. The noise was outrageous. The hall was packed with hungry travellers and the regular staff, all eating from an enormous pot of spiced oatmeal laced with nuts and dried fruits.
A few folk had managed to scrounge instruments, and a viol or a pipe or a drum and whistle or guitar was playing nearly the entire day in the hall, while people worked and prepared. Fresh rushes, mixed with evergreen sprigs, had been added to the floor, and I cast more mage lights to crowd the ceiling above, this time casting them in festive colours instead of just a soft white glow. And the food. Our gallant women had outdone themselves, creating a true feast in that ramshackle excuse for a kitchen. Nannerly ordered around her staff, freshly augmented by the newcomers, until there were a dozen fires being tended around the kitchen to accommodate all of the food. The feast was open to all in the vale, and to the folk of Brestong. I counted 3 oxen, 4 sheep, 9 goats, and countless fowl, from turkeys to doves. A brace of deer had been hunted, dressed, and roasted whole. Steamed roots and dishes of winter herbs, candied fruits and preserves simmered in pots. There were even cakes from our recently repaired but still woefully inadequate oven, and 2 casks of ale were breached and left open in the hall for all comers. Wine was limited to the nobility and the yeomanry, as we were running low, and I don't mind abusing my privilege like that. Perhaps it was not as fancy as the Duke's Yule, but everyone got plenty to eat, and that was saying a lot. Literally overnight, the population of Sevendor had grown dramatically, and that was a lot of mouths to feed. The Brestali who made the long trip were amazed at the transformation of the hall, and the way they looked hungrily at the food made me want to weep. I made certain everyone knew who Tyndall and Rondell were, Sir Tyndall and Sir Rondell, and let them demonstrate a few of the spells they had learned since I last saw them. Both were growing like weeds, too. Tyndall, who had been a skinny kid last Yule, when I'd chosen him to be my apprentice, had put on at least 20 pounds, all of it muscle. Rondell, on the other hand, seemed just as slender or more so, since he'd gained 2 inches in height. There wasn't a year's difference between them, and they did not seem like natural friends, I noted, but there was a grudging respect, even admiration, in each of their eyes when the other was given leave to show off. And both, they soon discovered, developed many eager young admirers among the Bovali maidens. Tyndall accepted their attentions eagerly, while Rondell didn't quite know what to do with them. When the dance music started, both were dragged repeatedly out into the midst of the hall by enthusiastic partners. I was glad to have the boys there. Now there were 3 high magi in Sevendor, and I felt some of the pressure on me abate. While neither one of them was even half trained, they both had picked up a few spells on their own, it seemed, and both were anxious to impress me. By nightfall, the entire fief seemed crowded into my hall, and as the longest night of the year began with the ritual bell sounding, I convened my first official court. It had been explained to me in one of my exhausting sessions with Lady Arnett that every landed noble had among his responsibilities the duty to render justice and honours to his subjects. Most high-ranking nobles delegate the duty to an underling, usually the seated lord of the domain, and some even hire actual trained law brothers for the job if it proves complicated. But every petty noble and country knight who controlled the smallest hamlet has the responsibility to hold court for his lands at least once a year. This was my first as seated lord of Sevendor, and I was a bit nervous about it. Sir Kay had placed 2 chairs for me and Alia at the head of the hall in front of the stone table, and hers even had a cushion. They were plain and unadorned, not even stained or finished yet, but they were big, heavy, and imposing. Over each one a nominal fringe of canopy was hung, denoting our status as sitting lord and lady. A horn blew after the final toll of the twilight bell rang, and Sagal, acting as my herald for the occasion, proclaimed loudly into the hall, "Before the gods and his subjects, Sire Minolin, the spellmonger, the mage lord of Sevendor, now sits at court. All those who seek judgment or consideration come forth and be heard." For his first time at the job, he did a pretty credible job. It helps to have a voice like a bull. The first items were the most important, the swearing of fealty by my yeomen. First, Raylan the Steady came on behalf of Sevendor Village and duly swore his allegiance and that of his district. He had no sword, of course, but he laid a staff of some apparent symbolic importance in front of me as he swore. I accepted his allegiance, and then surprised and startled him by granting him the yeomanry of Genly, including a charter for the right to mine clay, and a 3-year abeyance in taxes, as well as the fief's subsidy of a suitably impressive home. Raylan got choked up at the honour, particularly after I recounted to the crowd some of the things he'd done to stand up against bad old Sir Arental. I suppose a lord with more experience would have shied away from praising a peasant who resisted his rightful lord, but I was quickly learning that political expediency counted for more than I had thought it would in this job. I needed Raylan and most of his folk out of Sevendor Village, and I needed him to see it as a promotion, not a slight. So praising him as the first of my yeomen was politically astute, even if it ran against convention. The next yeoman to come to pledge to me was Gerlaw, who actually cleaned up pretty decently. He still wore a mantle of ox-hide, but his tunic and boots were bright and clean and almost festive. His unfortunate-looking wife held on to his arm like a queen to a king, and I noted that she was paid significant respect by the native Sevendori. She was a bored of rare humour, too, and later, after a few cups of wine, she had everyone laughing, describing the time she had the misfortune to see Sir Arental in the buff. Gerlaw placed his sword at my feet, as Sir Kay bade him, and I swore him to my service and to hold his lands in my name. Basic feudal stuff. He presented me with a gift, a cunningly wrought wooden rocking cradle, and his wife gave us 3 blankets for the infant. I was touched, and so was Lady Anya. I confirmed Gerlaw's present position, thanked him for his wise counsel, and gave him 3 gifts in return. First, the right to build on 3 lots nearest the village along the stretch of road closest to his holding, a boon Sir Arental had continuously refused the man. Those lots could be used to house his children or rented, but once improved they would increase his revenue dramatically. Secondly, I reduced his tributes to their proper level. Sir Arental had done all he could to press Gerlaw enough to goad the man into something rash, including doubling his tribute on a pretext. Gerlaw had struggled to pay it, but for the last 5 years he had paid every penny due. As a result, his own people had suffered, and he hadn't been able to turn his hold toward prosperity. Lastly, I gave his house a sheaf of 20 new spears, brought with the caravan's supplies. He accepted it graciously, but the implication was clear. I expect you to be able to lead at least 20 men from your district if I raise my war banner. Gerlaw had maybe 11, if you counted his stripling of an oldest son. That meant that Gerlaw would have to recruit more men to fill that quota. Now that he had increased revenue and half as much tribute due, he might be able to do that, especially with all of these landless Bovali wandering around. Carcan of Cowland's Pass was next. He was a short, rotund man in his middle years, with a fleshy face that turned red in an instant if he got excited, and an unruly shock of blonde hair that resembled a fur bough. He had come alone, save his eldest daughter, a lean, rangy-looking woman near Alia's age. She eschewed a gown for leather pants, but her height and bearing gave her plenty of notice among the men in the hall. Neither of them spoke much all evening. He placed his bow and sword at my feet and mumbled his way through the oath. I gifted Carcan with a small keg of brandy and a huge wheel of cheese, as well as a fine Wilderland's longbow with a quiver of arrows. It was nearly twice the length of the bow he carried, but it was such a fine weapon he cradled it like a baby all night. I assured him that I would have one of my Bovali come up to his croft to teach him to shoot it properly. In addition, I gave him permission to charge a toll of 1 copper penny for each man who wished to cross his pass, with my leave, save those who went on my business, and 1 silver penny for every cart that made its way up the pass. Since he was effectively guarding Sevendor's back door, I thought that letting the man profit from the service was only proper. Sir Arental had insisted on 1/2 of the tolls. I reduced that to 1 in 4. Carcan seemed grateful enough, although his hawk-like daughter stared at me thoughtfully all night. Then Brandine the Reeve and a delegation of the villagers of Gurisham came and pledged their loyalty, for what it was worth, as the Gurisham men were mostly villeins, bondsmen of one sort or another, and collectively the hamlet was deeply in debt to the castle, according to the pegboard. They had also worked tirelessly at our direction, mostly without complaint, and compared to the resistance Raylan and his folk had been displaying, they seemed eager for the changes I was making. They had welcomed the few Bovali they'd been able to settle, even though they were all freemen, and Brandine added that the commune had agreed to set aside up to 5 more lots for settlement, if they could get assistance in rebuilding their aging, decrepit silo. That was very generous, for a poor hamlet like Gurisham, where every rod of land was jealously guarded. Sure, they were kissing my ass, but they didn't have to. I felt a grand gesture was called for. Although the sum of their debt was substantial, amounting to 18 ounces of silver and change, I forgave it utterly as a gift to the hamlet, which shocked the hall and inspired more tears. The villeins I gave a 1-year stay on their taxes, and to the few freemen I gave permission to hunt south of the road, and as far up it as the gate tower, something that had been denied by Sir Erenthal. I promised that, come spring, every family in the hamlet would get a she-goat and 2 laying hens. You'd think I'd given them riches. I also gave them 20 spears. Those were less welcome. The Gurisham villagers were a timid lot. But in addition, I gave them 20 ounces of silver to fund the construction of a common manor hall for the hamlet, including the right to build a shrine within, if they so chose. And since that would also serve as the Reeves' residence, Brandine was beside himself with gratitude. Next came 4 stern-looking young men led by an even younger man, a lad of 17, if that. He had just a hint of fuzz on his cheeks, but he had a regal bearing and carried himself well. He and his comrades all wore an embroidered wolf's head badge on their cloaks, and all carried bows and swords. His wolf's head hung on a pendant around his neck, and was of silver. The lad turned out to be Kaya, son of Carmen, yeoman of the Westwood. The men were all part of his extended family, apparently, cousins or uncles or such. The Westwood men had been the original inhabitants of the Vale, according to legend, present here long before the Lensleys had led the conquest of the valley. They looked different, from their dark shiny hair and olive complexions to their rustic clothing. These men were hunters and warriors, the best I'd seen in Sevendor thus far. They were an insular lot, but they seemed open enough to their new lord. They had damn sure hated the old one enough. In strong, clear tones, young Kaya pledged his family's loyalty and fealty in his father's name, and begged my pardon for his absence, as he had fallen and broken his leg. In token of his pledge, he brought 3 magnificent bucks taken in the forest, well-aged and salted, and a bushel of pecans. I'd taken some counsel with Sir Kay before choosing his gift, and gave him another fine Wilderland's bow and quiver, which he took with great interest. I also gave them a keg of brandy and a thick woolen blanket for his ailing father. The Westwood was actually not all that far from the castle, but it wasn't easy to get to. Westwood Hall was a relatively unfortified manor hall of a simple design, but it lay on the other side of a great crevasse, and could only be reached by a long, rickety bridge. A single Westwood lad could sit at one end and snipe at anyone who tried to cross it, and the last section could be collapsed in an instant, at need. No one forced the Westwood men to do anything they didn't feel like doing, and they didn't like kissing a lot of noble ass. Apparently, after Sir Erenthal tried to send a man to collect extra tribute the first time, the poor man lost his footing and fell to his doom. So did the second one. After that, he quit worrying about the Westwood men and left them alone. They seemed very curious about me, however, and asked Sir Kay many searching questions about me and my story. Sir Kay in turn reported that young Kyle was a lad of quick wit and piercing intelligence, as well as confident without being cocky, a difficult balance for anyone, much less a 17-year-old. Tyndall sure as hell's hadn't managed that yet. Carmen's men were his men. They obeyed him as they would a military commander, and they drank only sparingly, though they enjoyed the feast as eagerly as anyone else. Yeoman Ilveen of Southridge came forward with his wife and children, all of them looking scrubbed, dour, and disapproving. He seemed to leer evilly at everyone in sight, as if he suspected them all of being ready to murder him. He kept glancing up at the cloud of spherical mage lights overhead, as if they might smite him. His hand never strayed too far from his sword either, something of which I took note.
Yeoman Ilveen of Southridge Hold, do you stand ready to swear your oath to the Mage Lord?
Asked Sagal, according to rote.
What difference does it make?
He complained, looking around at all of the strange Bavali faces.
Southridge Hold is all that's left of old Sevendor, and now my lord's rash actions have put us at odds with one of the most powerful nobles in the Bontol Riverlands.
There was a sharp murmur of outrage at the man's affront, during what was supposed to be a solemn and festive occasion.
I speak true, he shouted above the din. You took Brestall Vale from Sire Gimbal of West Flaria, and it will be all our doom. I pray you return it with an apology, my lord, and restitution.
The murmur rose again, and Sir Kay and Tyndall laid hands on their own sword hilts. I held up my hand to stay them. Let him speak, I invited. I wished to hear how reclaiming what is rightfully mine, granted by the hand of the Duke himself, is a matter for apologies and restitution.
My lord, if indeed you be a lord, he challenged boldly, inspiring another round of gasps, you are newly come to our land. You say that you were given Sevendor.
I will be happy to produce my warrants and patents from his grace if you wish to read them, I offered reasonably. If you cannot read, then surely Lady Arnott's seal on the documents will be easy to discern.
Whether they are or not, the truth is you have given grave insult to Sire Gimbal, he accused. I am loyal Sevendor, but you caught folly in your rash actions. Sire Gimbal is a powerful, powerful man. He controls the...
I care not what he controls, I interrupted. The important thing is that he no longer controls part of my lands he illegally stole.
He took Brastol by legal right of conquest, Ilveen protested. I was there. I watched the farms of Brastol and Sevendor village and Hyre's town burn and lost 6 men defending my holding.
Where were you?
He asked accusingly. I was loyally serving his grace on campaign in Faerice, I said darkly, while Sir Aaron Tal ran this fief into penury. As to right of conquest, as of 2 months ago, Sire Gimbal had not filed any writ of conquest with the duchy. Nor could he, as Sevendor was a property of the coronet, inviolate of private wars. So tell me again, Ilveen, why should I give back what was never his and pay restitution in the bargain? Shall I buy a drink for the man who robs my purse? The moral argument did not sway the man.
Sire Gimbal has 20 knights at Castle Kest alone. Should he raise his banners against us, he could field as many as 50 in just a few days, and hundreds of men-at-arms. He is not known as the war bird for nothing. You bring us to ruin, mage.
Mage Lord, I corrected warningly. I turned and addressed the rest of the hall, where there were plenty of outraged murmurs. My Bavali, Yeoman Ilveen, says that this lordling, Sire Gimbal, could bring as many as 150 men against us. 150. That is a powerful number. Sir Kay, can you recall how many goblins attacked Minden Hall the first night of the invasion?
Well over 100, my lord, my castellan replied smoothly.
Good man Sagal, can you recall how many goblins you faced the first time you had a sword in your hand?
Why, there were easily 2,000 or 3,000, Mage Lord, he assured me.
I turned to my wife. My lady, how many goblins did we face for weeks in the siege of Bovall Castle?
Oh, at least 500 or 600,000, my lord husband, she smirked. Of course, you were killing them in such great numbers that it was hard to keep track.
See why I love Alia? She always knows just what to say. So, tell us again, Yeoman Ilveen, what we have to fear from 150 human warriors. With that, the entire hall burst with laughter from the defiant Bavali.
Let them come, I continued, my eyes narrowing. Let them come and bring their kin and all of their men-at-arms. Let them empty all of West Flaria and bring them against us. And when they do, they still will be less than a pittance compared to what the Bavali have faced. Let them come.
Perhaps Sire Gimble found the old Sevendor, poorly armed and disgracefully led, to be an easy conquest. But let him raise his hand against the new Sevendori, and he will draw back a bloody stump.
The laughter quickly turned to loud, bold cheering. Ylvine looked terrified.
Yeoman Ylvine, clearly you fear the consequences of me taking what is rightfully mine, and clearly you have a deep and abiding respect for Sire Gimble. I hereby discharge you from your duties as yeoman, forgive your debts to the domain, and release you and your family to the frontiers. Please be on your way by sunset tomorrow. The yeoman's wife looked shocked, as did several of his henchmen, but Ylvine looked as if he expected it. Perhaps he had already started packing. Two sturdy men escorted Ylvine and his family out of the hall. I wasn't exactly sad to see him go. I hadn't liked the man from the moment I set eyes on him, but I didn't bear him any ill will, either. He disagreed with me. He didn't like me. He could find employment elsewhere. I seem to have a few vacant yeomanries now, I said, looking out at my subjects. That is not proper for the domain's defense and support. So, let us rectify that. I hereby designate Goodman Sagal to be the yeoman of Ferent's Hold, now to be called Sagal's Hold, or whatever name you wish. My brother-in-law quickly drew his blade and placed it at my feet, while my very pregnant sister-in-law, Ella, was crying tears of joy. From what I'd heard about her brief tenure at the manor, she had done a good job of restoring the hold to its proper state, or at least as much as could be done. I gave Yeoman Sagal leave to hunt the ridge between the vales at his leisure, fish his section of Ketta's stream, an important prerogative, and adjust the rents of his tenants as he saw fit. In addition, I granted him 20 ounces of silver, forgave the manor's debt to the castle, and gave him a sheaf of only 10 spears. Ferent's Sagal's Hold was sparsely populated. And to oversee the yeomanry of Southridge, I name Goodman Gurris, late of Beauval Vale, temporarily to the post. I turned to speak directly to the Southridgeman, who had remained in the hall after Ylvine's departure. Goodman Gurris is a fair man, a brave man, and a good administrator. If in a year's time we're both amenable, I shall make the appointment permanent. Gurris came forward with his wife and son, Gustal, and together they humbly swore fealty to me. I gave them a small herd of goats and 2 breeding llamas, as well as 50 pounds of flour and 20 spears. I didn't have to worry about Gurris finding able bodies to fight with them either. He'd been my neighbour in Minden's Hall, and he'd gone from being somewhat timid to a fierce goblin fighter, and escaped with his entire family intact. If I wanted a loyal man in Southridge, I couldn't have asked for better. I made a few more appointments along the way, including making Goodman Vanno, another herdsman from Beauval, who had once had the prized herd of the Vale, to the yeomanry of Brestall Village, in the absence of a local leader of note. The Brestalli present were suspicious, but the night had been so full of wonders for them that they did not seem to mind a new, strange reeve. Lastly, I appointed Goodman Rollo as yeoman of Brestall Farms, as the fertile plot in the northern end of the vale, near to the ruined Hire's Tower, was being called. I instructed him to build a village for his folk, to farm the croplands and tend the meadows, and support the rebuilt guard tower. That surprised and perhaps disturbed the former peasant. Like Sagal, I trusted Rollo's good sense and wisdom. He had once run a highly prosperous croft holding in Beauval, before the invasion. That life was far behind him now, buried with his wife and child. He had become a competent man-at-arms, and had seen his future in those terms. But he had the capability of managing and leading men. He was well-respected among the Beauvali, and since the new holding was the closest to the valley's mouth, I wanted a man capable of defending it as well as leading it in peacetime. I could see that the new responsibility fit uncomfortably on his shoulders, but I also knew that he was a good man who needed purpose. I granted him 50 ounces of gold for the effort, 2 ploughs, 5 oxen and 20 goats and hens for his maintenance and support while he oversaw the construction of the village. I appointed Captain Ferrando, the commander of Brestall Tower, where I instructed him to move the bulk of the garrison. The tower was better equipped to deal with that many soldiers, and we needed the room here in the West Tower, where they were currently billeted as we started rebuilding the place. I wanted Brestall Tower to be Seven Doors Militia Training Installation, where the professionals could instruct my peasantry in basic defence. It was also almost half an hour closer to the Dyke Tower and Dyke, so having the garrison there would be wiser. Captain Ferrando was pleased. It was the first time someone had given the bastard son of somebody important an actual landed post, and he seemed very grateful. After that, I ended court and bade everyone to eat and drink as much as they could, and led a few drunken choruses of traditional Yule songs before pouring myself into bed. Apparently, Alia wanted to take advantage of the longest night of the year. The holiday was well and truly over a few days later, and folk started getting to the business of finding their new positions as best they could. But there was trouble in the wind. Ilveen hadn't just been advocating on behalf of Sire Gimble. Despite his protests of loyalty to Sevendor, he was reporting to the Warbird. 3 days after Yule, I got a message just as I came down to breakfast from a Bovali lad on a pony who had ridden hard to get here fast from the dyke. There was a delegation from West Flaria at our new gate, and they were not happy.